This is VOA News. I'm Christina Menenti. On Wednesday at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, former President Donald Trump's vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, will speak to the crowd for the first time since his nomination. South Carolina alternate Republican delegate Karen Wilds says she's excited.
I don't know a whole lot about him, but the things I've seen when he's been interviewed on TV, I've liked him. He's strong. I like his background. So I think he'll be a good VP.
North Carolina Republican delegate Russ Ferguson likes that Vance is 39 years old.
I think it's good that he's young. He brings some energy to a ticket that is really two fairly elderly people running against each other. And so I think it does provide a little bit of contrast in that regard.
The Republican National Convention entered its third day on Wednesday. Republicans are expected to focus on Democratic President Joe Biden's handling of the ongoing crisis in Europe and the Middle East. Former Trump administration officials are also expected to take the stage. Democrats are aiming to nominate President Biden early next month, even as some push for him to quit the race. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The AP has obtained a letter sent to Democratic National Committee Rules Committee members, which says the panel will meet Friday to go over the plans. The party said in May it would hold an early roll call vote before the Democratic convention to make sure the president would qualify for Ohio's ballot, which originally had an August 7th deadline. That has changed, but the Biden campaign insists the party stick to the date. The letter comes a day after some House Democrats said an early vote would stifle debate about a nominee and be a terrible idea. Sagar Magani, Washington.
You'll find expanded coverage of world news and events at our website, voanews.com, 24 hours a day. This is VOA News. Southern Europe is baking under dangerous heat as this summer only continues to get hotter. For some tourists, that means attractions are being closed. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Greece's culture ministry has ordered the closure of the Acropolis, the country's biggest cultural attraction, for several hours in the middle of a day, while authorities warn of extreme heat as southern Europe swelters in sizzling temperatures. Daisy Hatzis from Chicago missed the opening hours of the site.
I wish that they didn't, because we're here to go up there, but I also understand that they may know more than I do, and that they're worried that people may not feel well and then they'll have to rescue them. People push themselves more than they should.
Meteorologists say the hot air from Africa is forecast to continue for several more days. Temperatures expected to reach 109 Fahrenheit. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Six foreign nationals were found dead in a luxury hotel room in central Bangkok on Tuesday, Thailand's prime minister said. Matthew Miller, U.S. State Department spokesperson, offered sympathies.
We are aware of the reports of the deaths of two U.S. citizens in Bangkok, Thailand. We offer our sincere condolences to the families on their loss. We are closely monitoring the situation and stand ready to provide consular assistance to those families.
Traces of cyanide were found in the cups of those found dead, police said on Wednesday. French security services on Wednesday arrested a right-wing sympathizer in eastern France on suspicion of plotting attacks to take place during the Paris Olympics, the interior minister said. The young man was the administrator of a Telegram group called French Aryan Division, where he made threats against the Olympics, is being questioned by anti-terror police, French daily Le Parisien said. AP correspondent Donner Water reports on the frustrations felt by some Houston residents who have gone without power for over a week.
Mayor John Whitmire says they're taking their anger out on the very linemen who are working to restore service. Reportedly, guns are being drawn, rocks are being thrown, and threatening messages are being sent.
These linemen are our friends. Quit threatening linemen. HPD is present at our staging centers. Will escort linemen to their workstations.
Beryl knocked out power to nearly 3 million people in Texas, mostly in the Houston area. As of Wednesday morning, more than 50,000 homes and businesses were still without electricity. I'm Donna Water.
Belarusian authorities have expanded visa-free travel for residents of 35 European countries, including members of the European Union and the United Kingdom, as part of authoritarian President Alexander Lukashenko's efforts to improve relations with the West. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. Here he is, Wuhib, in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The situation of drought and the impact of drought in Zimbabwe is impacting particularly in the districts in the rural provinces. We're speaking about Matabeleland South and North, Mashona Land East, West and Central, Manicaland and Mashingo.
That's UNICEF's Chief Communications Officer for Zimbabwe, Yves Wilmont, on the increasing levels of malnutrition in Zimbabwe. Details coming up. Also, global organizations say there will be large-scale migration from Africa in the near future on a level not seen in centuries. And Human Rights Watch is calling for greater accountability of public funds in Kenya. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. U.S. voters are assessing the impact of Saturday's attempted assassination of presidential candidate Donald Trump. As VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports, they are considering what the shooting means for the country and for this November's election.
Take a look at what happened. Oh.
Donald Trump's shooting shocked a nation deep into a divisive political campaign. Delegates at the Republican Party's convention here in the Midwest state of Wisconsin gathered to pray for their candidate and said the shooting will only make him stronger. Harrison Musselwhite is from South Carolina.
It's made all of us, including President Trump, more determined to fight and win. President Trump has the same spirit that Winston Churchill had. We'll fight them on the beaches. We'll fight them in the cities. We'll fight them in the streets. And this time, we are going to fight and win.
Wisconsin voter James Hauser says there's no place for violence in American politics.
People have their own opinions. Nobody should get shadowed with their own opinions. I mean, that's why we vote, who goes in. I mean, we have to stop shooting people.
Missouri voter Amy DeClue says Trump surviving the shooting broadens his appeal.
Every time something happens to him, I feel like it solidifies his win even more. So he's kind of reached legendary status. He's gone through all of these things and he just keeps on going.
In New York, voters interviewed by VOA were troubled by what the shooting means for American politics.
Like most normal people, I was horrified. It's something that should never take place in America. We should be better than that. Both sides need to be better than that.
Talk out your differences. Talk out your differences. There's no need to try to kill people over them.
I'm not a President Trump fan. Joe Biden all the way. I just think that both sides need to just tone it down a little bit. It's not worth anyone losing their life over political views.
The shooting at a Trump rally in Pennsylvania shows the need to lessen political tensions, says Tennessee voter Laura Bager.
I think that we need to lower the rhetoric and the anger. Why can't we just talk to each other? There is so much of everybody ramping and amping everything up. It's crazy. And there's just no reason for it. We need unity. We need to start talking to each other, speaking with each other, listening to each other.
Pennsylvania voter Kristen Billett says the shooting shows the need for more security.
It's sad that it happened because innocent people died, but I feel that more security for everybody right now until things calm down a little bit.
Back in Wisconsin, Dawn Goodman believes Saturday's violence will shift American politics.
Regardless of whether it was Biden or Trump, I mean, like to try to assassinate a president, it's just wrong. And it's in the long run, he's a human being, whether it was Biden or Trump. And the people that got involved in, you know, the shooting behind Trump, you know, that's a family that, you know, needs our prayers and thoughts as well.
The Trump and Biden campaigns have both toned down some of their rhetoric since the shooting, with Trump telling the New York Post that he has rewritten parts of the acceptance speech he'll give here Thursday night to focus on bringing the nation together. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Milwaukee.
VOA's Russian, Spanish, Persian, and Korean language services also contributed to this report. Our reporter, Carol Van Dam, is covering the Republican National Convention in the U.S. state of Wisconsin in the city of Milwaukee. She now joins us live to update us on the latest from the convention. Welcome to African News Tonight, Carol.
Thanks, Yehia. It's nice to be with you.
So, several former Republican presidential candidates spoke on the convention floor last night, throwing their support behind Donald Trump and saying he must be elected president in 2024. What speech stood out to you?
Well, yes, we heard from his, you know, former Republican opponents to get the nod from the Republican Party for being their presidential candidate, among them Nikki Haley, you know, the former U.N. ambassador and South Carolina governor, Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, and Vivek Ramaswamy. But, you know, what stood out kind of was how some of it's true what my colleague Scott Stern said, that, you know, they made this effort to lower the temperature. But there were some people who spoke before those former presidential candidates, like Governor Jim Justice, Republican Senate candidate from West Virginia, who warned, you know, kind of ramping up the rhetoric, the negative rhetoric again, saying that the country would become totally unhinged if Donald Trump is not elected in November. And ironically, those are the word unhinged is what Nikki Haley used previously when she was running for that presidential nomination to describe Donald Trump. So things have turned around quite a bit. Now, one of the things Nikki Haley did say last night was, although she was throwing her support behind Donald Trump, she said to the crowd, you know, you don't have to be 100% behind what Donald Trump has said in the past and all of his policies to vote for Donald Trump. They want the Republicans to be together on this.
So who is speaking tonight?
Well, of course, we have in the spotlight tonight J.D. Vance. He's the freshman Ohio Republican senator, and you know, just 2 days ago was announced to be the VP candidate for Mr. Trump. So
the vice presidential candidate.
Yes, and so, you know, all eyes will be on him. There will, of course, be other speakers before he gets up on stage tonight. But everybody will, you know, be excited. And you know, what's also interesting, Yehias, is throughout this convention event here in Milwaukee, Trump has been there in the front row on kind of an elevated platform with Vance every night since he announced on Monday that Vance was his ticket. That, you don't always see that in a convention, a national convention, but he's been there every single night.
So talk to us about the delegates and if they are unified in their support for Donald Trump. What is the atmosphere there in the room?
Yeah. So, you know, we were watching the speeches last night, and some of them, you know, brought down the House, just literally brought down the House. A lot of them were behind Sarah Sanders, the governor, who was a former press secretary to Donald Trump, when she threw her complete enthusiastic support behind the former president and, you know, got sustained applause. Everybody was up on their feet for her and for a couple of things that Ron DeSantis said, too. When he urged people to get behind Trump, you know, saying, you know, we really don't have a choice here. It has to be Trump. It can't be President Joe Biden.
VOA's Carol Van Dam at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
And remember, you can find out more about the convention and the U.S. presidential campaign at voaafrica.com and voanews.com. Human Rights Watch is calling for greater accountability of public funds in Kenya, framing it partially as a human rights issue. The group's statement was made as Kenya witnesses fresh protests that were originally sparked by proposed tax hikes and alleged government corruption. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenyans have taken to the streets for the fourth consecutive week to protest the high cost of living, corruption, and misuse of the country's finances. What began as a tax protest has morphed into a demand for the end of President William Ruto's government, with demonstrators saying they do not trust it to solve the country's political and economic problems. Human Rights Watch is calling on the International Monetary Fund, IMF, to work with the Kenyan government to ensure IMF support for the country is aligned with human rights and that corruption doesn't take funds meant to improve the lives of ordinary people. Alan Ngari is the Africa Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch.
Our greatest concern is that the outrage sparked by the proposed taxes is really something that is endemic in Kenya, in the sense that corporate tax evasion, for example, is one of the issues that haven't really been taken into consideration. In addition to the opulence lifestyles that we have seen among the Kenyan executive.
Due to pressures from credit and debt payments in Kenya, the IMF approved $941 million for the country in January, bringing the total the East African nation received from the financial agency to $3.9 billion. Kenyans have raised concerns about such heavy borrowing, saying it is not doing much to improve their lives. At the same time, protesters say civilians are paying more taxes so Kenya can repay the loans. The IMF argues that the money it provided to Kenya helped alleviate market concerns, allowing the East African nation access to the bond market and partially rolling over a maturing Eurobond. Ngari says the Kenyan government needs to be accountable to the IMF, other foreign loan providers, and the revenue it collects in the country.
What we think in terms of accountability is monies that have been allocated or that are within government expenditure should be for projects and processes of development in the country. That's the reason why these loans are being sought. And so, you know, accountability is that one, that the public should be really fully aware of the extent of the borrowing.
Activists have repeatedly asked the government to disclose the country's total current debt, especially the amount owed to China, which the government has been reluctant to make public. President Ruto has formed a task force to audit the country's debt and report back by the end of September. In the streets of many cities and towns, protesters continue to cry out about hard economic times and a government they say has become blind and deaf to its problems. Sharon, a Nairobi resident, says that if the board money can be accounted for and used for intended purpose, it will improve the situation of many Kenyans.
Kenya, we need accountability for the money we pay and for the money we borrowed. Yeah. It will create more employment opportunities because there will be money to pay for those jobs.
Stella Nkiroite is a 30-year-old street vendor and a mother of four. She says corruption has hampered the country's economic growth.
Corruption wacha ishe kitu ya kwanza. Corruption ikisha inchi ya Kenya iko sawa.
She says if corruption ends in this country, Kenya will be fine. Kenya, we have a lot of money and we are blessed. But those people in power are bad. They have refused to use the money how it is supposed to be used. If you go to the government offices, even if you're educated, they will ask for money, about 50,000 shillings. Where do you get such money? And you have been out of work for 5 years. You continue to remain jobless. In its 2016 periodic review of Kenya, the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights said the country has large amounts of illicit financial flows, tax avoidance, and cases of corruption involving top government officials that are not investigated. Human Rights Watch argues that many countries' problems could be solved if they align their economic policies with human rights on every level, domestic and international. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Zimbabwe and neighboring Malawi and Zambia are among the countries in southern Africa most affected by malnutrition after a severe drought, which experts say was worsened by the El Nino weather phenomenon. UNICEF's chief communications officer for Zimbabwe, Yves Wilmot, tells me that at least 7.6 million people are in need of aid. The most affected are children, and he says the United Nations Children's Agency is very concerned about the increasing levels of malnutrition in Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe is going through a situation of drought, which was created by El Nino, which started basically, the drought started basically in December last year. The situation has created a lot of challenges for the population throughout the country in Zimbabwe, with a harvest that was largely lost. We estimate that more than 60% of the crops were lost. And the population has challenges in accessing food and accessing water. Children are among the most affected. We are, as UNICEF, very concerned about the increasing levels of malnutrition. We are also worried about the risk of increased numbers of diarrheal diseases. And the situation of drought has been exacerbated by the health emergencies that the country has been going through, with cholera, which was declared back in February 2023, and with also a polio crisis. So this all together puts families in Zimbabwe, and particularly the children, at high risk of diseases and of malnutrition.
So, Ibs, you have been quoted as saying harvest has not been what it should be in Zimbabwe. And most people, you say, are living in a pretty dire situation with lack of access to water and food. Where in Zimbabwe is the situation most dire? And what is your organization, UNICEF, doing in particular to combat malnutrition in the affected localities?
The situation of drought and the impact of drought in Zimbabwe is impacting particularly in the districts in the rural provinces. We're speaking about Matabeleland South and North, Mashona Land East, West and Central, Manicaland and Mashingo. There we will find a high level of high numbers of communities that are suffering from the lack of access to food and water. As children are the most affected by the challenges, we as UNICEF, together with the government of Zimbabwe and the partners, we have put in place multiple programs to increase the resilience of the population and to help children to continue to receive a diversified and a nutritious alimentation food, so that malnutrition can be avoided.
In May, President Emmerson Mnangagwa declared the state of disaster, saying Zimbabwe needed at least $2 billion to respond to the drought. And in early June, the UN launched a $429 million drought appeal for Zimbabwe. So, Eves, what has the response been so far regarding the appeals?
UNICEF has launched a couple of weeks ago, on the 30th of May, appeal for El Nino for an amount of $84.9 million to scale up our programs in health, in nutrition, in water sanitation and hygiene, but also in the areas of education and child protection. Unfortunately, until now, we haven't received any contribution from the donor community. So the programs that we are rolling out today, we are funding them with our internal resources, as well as resources that we have received from the SURF funding from the United Nations.
That was UNICEF's chief communication officer for Zimbabwe, Yves Welmont. He talked to me from Harare. Global organizations say there will be large-scale migration in the near future on a level not seen in centuries, with possibly 1 million people immigrating every year. The United Nations says, with Africa's population expected to double to 3 billion people by 2050, and youth unemployment across the continent already at an all-time high, more Africans will feel they have no choice but to move elsewhere. Darren Taylor reports.
François Héron, chairperson of the Migration and Societies Project at the Collège de France in Paris, says right-wing groups across the world are using African emigration to spread fear and to discriminate against Africans. Now and in the future, he says, the numbers of Africans emigrating to Europe, the Americas, and elsewhere will be lower than the numbers of Asians moving, for example.
The panic, the real panic we have about African migration in Europe is completely exaggerated. We are struck by images of all these African people disembarking in Lampedusa in Italy. But Italy is a sort of highway with only one entry opened. And it's not surprising that sometimes there are a bottleneck, which is very spectacular. There is a zooming effect in the vision we have of African migration. But the emigration rate of Africa is not that high.
Héron was speaking during a recent Atlantic Council webinar on African migration. Osagie Imasogi was another participant in the webinar. He's an entrepreneur and law professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the United States, and also is an advisor to President Joe Biden on the African diaspora. Imasogi also says there's nothing unusual about the rise of migration from Africa.
When the Irish migration occurred into the U.S., what drove it? Major famine in Ireland, oppression by the British, political instability. This is the norm. It's important to keep that in mind, because many times when we talk about migration today, we look at it from a political perspective, and there's this perception that, oh my God, Africa is falling apart, that's why people are migrating. And I'm like, check your history. This is what happened in Europe.
Nevertheless, says former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Constance Berry Newman, projections show almost 75 million Africans will be living abroad in 2050, up from the current 47 million. Her research among young Nigerians shows 7 out of 10 below the age of 30 want to leave Africa's most populous country.
Japa is a very interesting Yoruba word that means fleeing with panic. And that's what's really thought of by the youth. They're more worried about staying than leaving. And they're thinking of ways they can leave and get jobs, because what we find with the Nigerians who come to places like Chicago or go to London, that they are actually very successful. Successful in getting high-level positions because they're among the most educated of the immigrants into the U.S. and into London.
Andrew Selly, president of the Migration Policy Institute, says many Africans will move in the future, not only because of poor economic conditions, conflict, climate change, and other adverse factors, but also because the world's going to need them.
We are going to see more international migration in larger chunks and larger distances. And it's as much about demand as it is about supply, right? I mean, it is about the doubling of the population in Africa. So that's where people will come from. But it's also because you have countries like Italy and Spain and Germany and Denmark that are reaching a point where their labor markets have started to decline in some cases. Mm-hmm. East Asia, parts of the Americas. And there's going to be a demand for workers. And Africa will be the place where there are the largest number of people coming in working age. This is going to create mobility, whether we like it or not. And so we got to figure out how we create the legal pathways that make this happen in an orderly way, because it's going to happen one way or the other.
To avoid a crisis in the future, says Selly, African governments and their counterparts elsewhere must plan structures that ensure migration from the continent benefits sending and receiving countries. Should Africa lose the skills and labor it desperately needs for its own development, Selly says, there's going to be even more suffering and instability to the detriment of the world. He says what's needed is a globally coordinated effort by experts and governments to determine which skills and how many people Africa will need in the future, and how to develop and nurture those skills and people going forward. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.